From NPR News, this is Special Election Coverage 2016. I'm Corva Coleman. Republican candidate Donald Trump is now President-elect Donald Trump. He won the last Electoral College votes about 2:30 this morning Eastern Time when Wisconsin was finally called for the GOP nominee. Hillary Clinton has telephoned the President-elect to concede the election. How did Trump pull off this electoral upset? In what states did Hillary Clinton fall short? We'll listen to election analysis about what demographic groups went big for Trump and which groups did or did not turn out for Hillary Clinton. Republicans have also kept control of both the House and the Senate, so President-elect Trump will enter office with members of his party in full control of Congress. We'll take a look at all of this, plus listen to Donald Trump's victory speech from New York early this morning. Stay tuned. First, we go to Ray Suarez to review last night's surprising election results. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Corva. It is an amazing thing to consider that when Donald Trump walked up to the podium tonight, he was giving a victory speech that culminated his first ever run for public office. Nothing like starting at the top in your political career. He's now the president-elect of the United States. He told a rapturous crowd in New York that he will serve all the people of all political parties and bring the country together to renew the American dream. He looked back on his business career and said, what I did in business, I now want to do for our country. And he wants to do it, he said, in the name of the forgotten men and women of our country who, he said, quote, will be forgotten no more. He promised to embark on a major program of rebuilding America's infrastructure and putting millions of people back to work. He wants to usher in an era of growth and stability and renewal for the country. It is a remarkable thing. Donald Trump is now the president-elect of the United States. In just a few months' time, he'll go to the west front of the Capitol building and take the oath of office as the 45th president of the United States.
Ray, this result is very surprising. Most polls had suggested that Hillary Clinton was going to win this race. The polls, in fact, were very narrow. They were very tight, but had consistently showed that she was ahead. Do we have any idea what might have happened?
Well, the models probably had some problems because they converged around a consensus view of the size and shape of the electorate and the size and shape, frankly, of what was going to be an eventual Hillary Clinton victory. They saw Wisconsin going her way, North Carolina, Florida, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania. It's likely she didn't win any of them. Yes, there was a good night in places like Nevada and, of course, a sweep up the West Coast with Washington, Oregon, and California, which had been solid all the time. A nail biter in Virginia and a solid New England and Mid-Atlantic. But boy, oh boy, key races that they needed to win to have any plausible hope of making it to 270 electoral votes, those exits, those paths were cut off very early in the night as Hillary Clinton was trailing in states where she was expected from the very beginning, since the nominating conventions, to prevail.
You know, it's not just the presidential race that we're talking about. There had been some hope that Democrats might take control of the Senate, if not the House, but it appears that the Republicans will still control 51 seats in the Senate.
There were many scenarios that were being played out where even if it was a 50-50 tie in the United States Senate, the Democrats would have effective control because Vice President-elect Tim Kaine, a member of the Senate himself, would preside over the next Congress as the president of the Senate, one of the jobs of the vice president, and supply the 51st tie-breaking vote. Of course, as we now know, that's not going to happen, but the Democrats didn't even really get close to that outcome. They had high hopes for places like Missouri, where Roy Blunt was facing some heavy headwinds as a long-term incumbent and somebody very well known to Missourians in an anti-incumbent year. Evan Bayh was trying to return to politics in Indiana. He was turned back. What had been a very popular Governor Strickland in Ohio came back from off the sidelines to try to join the United States Senate after his long service as an elected official in Ohio. He was turned back as well. Even Patrick Toomey, who had been counted out for dead very early in the going against McGuinty, did prevail. He hung on. He will be returning even after he came to office in an off-year election when the electorate in Pennsylvania is very different. One possible bright spot, New Hampshire, where Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan, the governor of New Hampshire, are still locked in a very tight battle.
Thanks, Ray. Let's take this minute to listen back to Donald Trump's victory speech. Here it is in full.
Thank you very much, everybody. Sorry to keep you waiting. Complicated business. Complicated. Thank you very much. I've just received a call from Secretary Clinton. She congratulated us, it's about us, on our victory. And I congratulated her and her family on a very, very hard-fought campaign. I mean, she fought very hard. Hillary has worked very long and very hard over a long period of time, and we owe her a major debt of gratitude for her service to our country. I mean that very sincerely. Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division. We have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. It's time. I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans, and this is so important to me. For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country. As I've said from the beginning, ours was not a campaign, but rather an incredible and great movement made up of millions of hardworking men and women who love their country and want a better, brighter future for themselves and for their family. It's a movement comprised of Americans from all races, religions, backgrounds, and beliefs who want and expect our government to serve the people, and serve the people it will. Working together, we will begin the urgent task of rebuilding our nation and renewing the American dream. I've spent my entire life in business looking at the untapped potential in projects and in people all over the world. That is now what I want to do for our country. Tremendous potential. I've gotten to know our country so well. Tremendous potential. It's going to be a beautiful thing. Every single American will have the opportunity to realize his or her fullest potential. The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer. We are going to fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure, which will become, by the way, second to none. And we will put millions of our people to work as we rebuild it. We will also finally take care of our great veterans. You've been so loyal, and I've gotten to know so many over this 18-month journey. The time I've spent with them during this campaign has been among my greatest honors. Our veterans are incredible people. We will embark upon a project of national growth and renewal. I will harness the creative talents of our people, and we will call upon the best and brightest to leverage their tremendous talent for the benefit of all. It's going to happen. We have a great economic plan. We will double our growth and have the strongest economy anywhere in the world. At the same time, we will get along with all other nations willing to get along with us. We will be. We'll have great relationships. We expect to have great, great relationships. No dream is too big. No challenge is too great. Nothing we want for our future is beyond our reach. America will no longer settle for anything less than the best. We must reclaim our country's destiny and dream big and bold and daring. We have to do that. We're going to dream of things for our country and beautiful things and successful things once again. I want to tell the world community that while we will always put America's interests first, we will deal fairly with everyone, All people and all other nations. We will seek common ground, not hostility, partnership, not conflict. And now I'd like to take this moment to thank some of the people who really helped me with this, what they are calling tonight, very, very historic victory. First, I want to thank my parents, who I know are looking down on me right now. Great people. I've learned so much from them. They were wonderful in every regard. I had truly great parents. I also want to thank my sisters, Marianne and Elizabeth, who are here with us tonight. And where are they? They're here someplace. They're very shy, actually. And my brother, Robert, my great friend. Where is Robert? Where is Robert? My brother, Robert. And they should all be on this stage, but that's okay. They are great. And also my late brother, Fred. Great guy. Fantastic guy. Fantastic family. I was very lucky. Great brothers, sisters, great, unbelievable parents. To Melania and Don. And Ivanka. And Eric. And Tiffany. And Baron. I love you and I thank you. And especially for putting up with all of those hours. This was tough. This was tough. This political stuff is nasty and it's tough. So I want to thank my family very much. Really fantastic. Thank you all. Thank you all. And Lara, unbelievable job. Unbelievable. Vanessa, thank you. Thank you very much. What a great group. You've all given me such incredible support, and I will tell you that we have a large group of people. You know, they kept saying we have a small staff. Not so small. Look at all the people that we have. Look at all of these people. And Kellyanne, and Chris, and Rudy, and Steve, and David. We have got tremendously talented people up here, and I want to tell you, it's been very, very special. I want to give a very special thanks to our former mayor, Rudy Giuliani. He's unbelievable. Unbelievable. He traveled with us, and he went through meetings. See that, Rudy? Never changes. Where's Rudy? Where is he? Rudy. Governor Chris Christie, folks, was unbelievable. Thank you, Chris. The first man, First senator, first major, major politician. Let me tell you, he is highly respected in Washington because he's as smart as you get. Senator Jeff Sessions. Where's Jeff? Great man. Another great man. Very tough competitor. He was not easy. He was not easy. Who is that? Is that the mayor that showed up? Is that Rudy? Oh, Rudy got up here. Another great man who has been really a friend to me. But I'll tell you, I got to know him as a competitor because he was one of the folks that was negotiating to go against those Democrats. Dr. Ben Carson. Where's Ben? Where is Ben? And by the way, Mike Huckabee is here someplace, and he is fantastic. Mike and his family, Sarah, thank you very much. General Mike Flynn. Where is Mike? And General Kellogg. We have over 200 generals and admirals that have endorsed our campaign, and they're special people, and it's really an honor. We have 22 Congressional Medal of Honor recipients. We have just tremendous people. A very special person who, believe me, and, you know, I'd read reports that I wasn't getting along with him. I never had a bad second with him. He's an unbelievable star. He is, that's right, how did you possibly guess? So let me tell you about Reince. And I've said this. I said Reince, and I know it. I know it. Look at all those people over there. I know it. Reince is a superstar. But I said, they can't call you a superstar, Reince, unless we win. Because you can't be called a superstar like Secretariat. If Secretariat came in second, Secretariat would not have that big, beautiful bronze bus at the track at Belmont. But I'll tell you, Reince is really a star. And he is the hardest working guy. And in a certain way, I did this. Reince, come up here. Where is Reince? Get over here, Reince. Boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. It's about time you did this, Reince. Huh? My God. Yeah, say a few words. Oh, come here. Say something.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States, Donald Trump. Thank you. It's been an honor. God bless. Thank God.
Amazing guy. Our partnership with the RNC was so important to the success and what we've done. So I also have to say I've gotten to know some incredible people, the Secret Service people. They're tough and they're smart and they're sharp, and I don't want to mess around with them, I can tell you. And when I want to go and wave to a big group of people and they rip me down and put me back down in the seat. But they are fantastic people, so I want to thank the Secret Service. And law enforcement in New York City, they're here tonight. These are spectacular people, sometimes underappreciated, unfortunately. But we appreciate them. We know what they go through. So it's been what they call a historic event. But to be really historic, we have to do a great job. And I promise you that I will not let you down. We will do a great job. We will do a great job. I look very much forward to being your president. And hopefully at the end of 2 years or 3 years or 4 years or maybe even 8 years, you will say, so many of you worked so hard for us, but you will say that that was something that you were really were very proud to do. And I can thank you very much. And I can only say that while the campaign is over, our work on this movement is now really just beginning. We're going to get to work immediately for the American people. And we're going to be doing a job that hopefully you'll be so proud of your president. You'll be so proud. Again, it's my honor. It was an amazing evening. It's been an amazing two-year period. And I love this country. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you to Mike Pence. Thank you, everybody.
That was Donald Trump speaking last hour from New York City. I'm Korva Coleman at NPR, and my colleague Ray Suarez is at member station KQED. He was on the air when Donald Trump delivered that speech. Ray, what were your impressions?
Well, it was a warm and conciliatory Donald Trump, quite different from the more combative model that we heard on the campaign trail. And as in a lot of acceptance speeches, he made some very big promises. He wants to double the growth rate of the United States, create millions of jobs, bring a divided country together, and do nothing less than renew the American dream. Those are some pretty tall orders. But he was clearly feeling his oats and gracious in victory, you'd have to say.
Well, Ray, let's listen back to some analysis from NPR's coverage earlier this evening. Our colleagues Ari Shapiro and Rachel Martin spoke with some of the NPR politics team about tonight's surprising victory by Donald Trump. Ari and Rachel were joined by NPR's Asma Khalid, Ron Elving, Ilsa Chang, and Susan Davis. And here's some of that conversation from earlier in the evening.
Let's talk about some of the key takeaways. And I guess one of the key takeaways is that the polls were very, very wrong. Leading up to the election, Hillary Clinton led in nearly every swing state. She led in nearly every national poll. And yet, Asma Khalid, we don't know why the polls were wrong, but can you offer some possibilities?
That's right. And I mean, look, I think there's a couple of key possibilities. I should say we don't know, and we likely will not know the answer until some of the pollsters themselves have a sort of autopsy to figure out what happened and what went on. But one theory is that some of the people who were called just, look, weren't honest with the pollsters themselves. And I say that partly, I mean, if we look at one key demographic that looked like it was going to go for Hillary Clinton are white college-educated voters. Mm-hmm. This was a group that had consistently been trending more towards Hillary Clinton in the national exit polls we have so far. Again, I'm relying on a poll, the national exit polls. It looks like Donald Trump won this group by about 4 percentage points. So that's one theory.
This is actually something that Kellyanne Conway, Trump's campaign manager, said on the air, was that people might have been embarrassed to admit they were voting for Trump.
Yeah, and it's a possibility. I mean, look, the other possibility is that maybe even within the modeling itself, it didn't account for what the electorate would look like. We may actually just have a larger percentage of white working class voters who participated today.
So just to be clear, pollsters actually adjust. They might get a group of 100 people that includes 60 white people, but if white people they think will actually be 55% of the voting population, they'll de-emphasize the weight of that group.
And
in
they
their
wait,
poll.
You know, say yeah. Latinos to be X percentage and whatnot. So it just could be that, you know, that there was not the correct modeling. And then the other theory is just that, you know, within the sort of plethora of polling is that, you know, there was sort of a herd mentality and no one pollster wanted to be the outlier.
Ron Elving, Hillary Clinton's campaign was banking on the fact that they thought they were going to get college educated Americans, but in particular, white women with college degrees.
Overall, college educated people voted for Hillary Clinton by a small margin. But if you take away from that group all the people of color who have college degrees, mm-hmm. and you leave just the white people, women still voted very narrowly, I think 51% as a majority for Hillary Clinton. But the men were another story. The men were voting for Donald Trump. Now, is it possible that because so much was said characterizing the Donald Trump vote as coming from people without college degrees, people who were, quote, blue collar, people who were disaffected. Is it possible that people talking to pollsters, possibly even exit pollsters, did not want to be so characterized because they thought of themselves as of another class, mm-hmm. a college-educated, more affluent class, and so they didn't own up to their intention to vote for Donald Trump? Or did they just somewhere along the line change their mind?
Yeah.
Or does it have something to do with the gender of the Democratic candidate?
We're going to go now to NPR's Ilsa Chang, who is in Nevada at the Democratic Party event there, the Aria Hotel, one of the bright spots for Democrats on a night that doesn't have too many of them, Ilsa.
It's been a weird mood in this room. There's been a lot of cheering because of, you know, the results for Clinton and for Catherine Cortez Masto, but there's a lot of nerves in this room right now.
This has been something of a Republican wave night, to the surprise of many people, but it was supposed to be a year when the map favored Senate Democrats. If the Democrats were ever going to take back the Senate, this was the year to do it. What went wrong?
Well, I'm talking to the voters here, there is a lot of blame for the Clinton letter from James Comey, the FBI director.
They blame the FBI.
A lot of people
director.
Are talking about tonight, yes, that last minute sort of supposed reopening of the investigation into the Clinton emails, and then a never mind last minute letter saying, you know, it wasn't the case that those emails were relevant or in any way determinative or dispositive. A lot of people here are laying blame for that. I've also heard a lot of people blame us in the media that we didn't do a good enough job of vetting Trump at the beginning. And that's kind of what's happened. He's gained a lot of momentum early on that he never lost throughout this entire election. There's a lot of anger in this room, actually, at the press here tonight, the Democratic headquarters.
All right. And NPR's Elsa Chang speaking with us from Las Vegas, Nevada. Thanks, Elsa.
You're welcome.
Ron Elving, you know, something I'm still confused about. We have a lot of questions, but this is one that's on my mind right now. What about these Republicans who were so skittish about aligning themselves with Trump? Was that unnecessary? I mean, did they win because of him, despite him?
There are a great number of Republican intellectuals, people like George Will, who actually changed his party registration to leave the Republican Party. But a lot of other writers, a lot of other people who have published over the years, many of the major Republican or conservative news organs, and particularly magazines of opinion, separated themselves from Donald Trump almost immediately, were against him all the way through, did not endorse him in the fall. But the dynamic of this race was that Donald Trump emerged in a huge field of candidates, 17 candidates, with maybe a third to a 40% of the Republican vote, but outlasted all of his other rivals. And once he did that, then he piled up a lot more of the vote in the late primaries, emerged at the convention completely unchallengeable because at that point he had about half the delegates in his corner, and he was clearly the only option. And after that, once he was the Republican nominee, he was, to some degree, normalized. He became another Republican nominee. And while a lot of the conservative intellectuals didn't like that or rejected that, and much of the Republican establishment, including many senators, rejected him, something like a fifth to a fourth of all Republican office holders nationwide actively separated themselves from him. Very unusual behavior for Republicans. But by and large, the Republican electorate, people who ever vote Republican, came around and said, well, on the other hand, if we have Donald Trump, we have the White House, the Senate, we have the House, we have the key vote on the Supreme Court to keep a conservative majority there, that's not such a bad world in comparison with having Hillary Clinton. So they voted for the Republican nominee, love him or not.
Ron, we know what a typical Republican administration in waiting might look like. Donald Trump is not a typical Republican. What would we imagine a Trump cabinet to possibly look like?
There have been a lot of theories already advanced that the people who have been his surrogates, and he has not had a large cast of surrogates by any means.
Talking about Jeff Sessions, Chris Christie, Rudy Giuliani.
That's right. Now, Chris Christie has some legal problems of his own going back to Bridgegate. Some of his associates have been found guilty in a trial in New Jersey. So he may be a little problematic, but he has been the person in charge of the transition team for the Trump campaign. And not a lot of people were paying a lot of attention to that transition team, but they will be tomorrow. Mm. And Rudy Giuliani is certainly a very strong prospect to be attorney general or something of that nature. We have heard Newt Gingrich's name mentioned to have a cabinet position in the top level of cabinet positions. And some of the other people who have been involved, Jeff Sessions, the senator, and possibly also Kellyanne Conway, the campaign manager, perhaps Steve Bannon, some of the other people who have been powerful, the CEO of his campaign, Steve Bannon, the publisher of Breitbart.com, might have a cabinet-level role.
Now, Breitbart is an organization that has trafficked in the kinds of conspiracy theories and outright falsehoods that were once sort of relegated to the fringes. And through Donald Trump, a lot of those sort of conspiracy theories and falsehoods entered the mainstream. Does that become I don't know, U.S. administration policy.
At least it becomes, in a sense, mainstream, does it not? I mean, if the media organizations that did support Donald Trump have supported the man who will now be president, if that is the case, then are they then not, in some sense, mainstream organs of the media? When people talk about the media doing their job or not doing their job, the first question to ask is, which media are you talking about? It's a much more varied cast than it used to be or than most people realize.
What would Trump's first 100 days look like? Because he's quick with a good quip and has got really strong rhetoric. There hasn't been a lot of meat on the bone when it comes to policies. And before I get your answer, Sue, Dave, you want to respond to that, Sue?
I just had a thought on that, because one thing that I've been thinking about throughout the course of this night, too, is two of the bets that Donald Trump made was that the white vote would turn out for him and that traditional Republicans would come home. And I think we've seen that traditional Republicans did come home. And one of the things that I heard throughout this election year, one issue that came up a lot was the Supreme Court. And the next president is going to certainly have one, if not three, vacancies to fill. And that was something that more traditional Republican voters, we heard earlier this evening talking about evangelical voters, that was a significant motivating factor for voting for Donald Trump, in part because he put out a list of justices or potential justices that he would nominate, including people like Mike Lee, the senator from Utah, who won his own reelection tonight. So the first 100 days of the next Congress, at least I can tell you, is going to be consumed by a Supreme Court nomination.
And, you know, it's interesting, when I've talked with Trump supporters, a lot of them cited the Supreme Court. I mean, I think it was perhaps underestimated how people who may not have college degrees are very attuned to this and understand the significance of the court, and that was motivating a lot of people's votes.
That was Ari Shapiro and Rachel Martin speaking with members of NPR's politics team. I'm NPR's Corva Coleman, and you're listening to Election Night coverage here from NPR. Ray Suarez is my colleague at KQED. Ray, what were your impressions of elections results, especially with Latino voters?
Well, Latino leaders in and out of the Democratic Party, those who were in independent political organizations and those who were part of the party process, were exultant in the last several days. They looked at the early vote and they looked at the turnout numbers and they thought they had demonstrated their prowess in registering and then getting out to vote a large number of people. You know, a Latino young person turns 18 every 30 seconds in this country, and that's going to go on for years to come. It is a new young voting force as we look to millennials and young people who are taking over in numbers from the boomers. They believed that if they helped put Hillary Clinton over the top, they would be able to demand the kind of seats at the table and the kind of access to the levers of power that sometimes they feel they've been denied in the past. Well, they turned out their numbers. They probably carried some states or made some states close that wouldn't have been otherwise. But because Hillary Clinton didn't win, it now is a really ambiguous effort to them. They did what they had to do, but then they didn't get the brass ring at the end of the ride. It'll be really interesting to see what conclusions they make in the coming days.
House Speaker Paul Ryan calls Trump's victory a repudiation of the status quo of failed liberal progressive policies. What might Trump be able to do to accomplish with Congress controlled by his own party, do you think?
Well, he has a big wish list explained again and again over the months, including repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, ending birthright citizenship. You'd need a constitutional amendment to do that. Recognize Russia's possession of the Crimean Peninsula, formerly part of the Ukraine. Lift sanctions on Russia. Lower the corporation tax. End the estate tax. A big, big set of big proposals that really would turn back the entire 8 years of Barack Obama. What he can do now that he's got both houses of Congress, he can make headway on a lot of these things. And, I've left one big one off
and
the
that
list.
Would be
take the United States name off the Paris Climate Treaty, which he has opposed from the very beginning and does not want the United States to be held to.
And that is very big with millennials, who did not necessarily turn out in big numbers for Clinton.
Yeah, I think when a lot of young voters see what they get, they're going to not necessarily get what they wished for.
I'm Corva Coleman. That is Ray Suarez. And you're listening to live election night coverage from NPR News.
You are listening to special election coverage here on Minnesota Public Radio News. Good morning. I'm Mike Moen. It's 3:35. We have some updates on hotly contested congressional races here in Minnesota. Over the past 30 minutes, the Associated Press has declared a trio of winners, including Republican Jason Lewis. He's been declared the winner in the race for the second congressional seat in Minnesota. He defeated Democratic challenger Angie Craig. Of course, Lewis will be replacing the retiring Republican John Klein in that district. In the 8th district, the AP has declared Rick Nolan the winner. The incumbent Democrat squared off against Republican Stuart Mills. The two also competed against each other in a very tight race back in 2014. And Democrat Tim Walz survives the GOP wave to hang on to his southern Minnesota seat. The AP says Walz squeaked past Republican challenger Jim Hagedorn. That was also a rematch from 2014. In the western Twin Cities suburbs, Republican Eric Paulson easily won re-election to a fifth term in Congress. Paulson beat his DFL challenger, State Senator Terry Bonoff, 57-43% in the 3rd District. Paulson says Bonoff was a tough competitor.
One of the challenges was a lot of outside money that came in from Washington, D.C. But I think voters understood and appreciated the fact that they don't like that voice coming from the outside.
Elsewhere in Minnesota, Democrat Betty McCollum and Republican Tom Emmer defeated their challengers to win re-election to Congress, and Democrat Keith Ellison also won re-election in the 5th District. In the state legislature, Minneapolis DFLer Ilhan Omar has become the first Somali-American candidate elected to a state legislature anywhere in the U.S. The 33-year-old beat longtime state representative Phyllis Kahn in the August primary in a heavily Democratic Minnesota House district.
I look forward to demystifying politics and changing narratives about who we are as people and what a vision of progress looks like.
Omar's Republican opponent, Abdumalik Oscar, who is also Somali-American, suspended his campaign in August to deal with family issues. Meanwhile, DFL leaders have conceded that the Minnesota House will remain in Republican hands, and the Associated Press is reporting Republicans will have the upper hand in the battle for control of the Minnesota Senate. The final word will hinge on close elections in Lakeville and Apple Valley, and a pair of races in Plymouth and St. Cloud that favored Republicans are headed for an automatic recount because of tiny margins of victory. Again, that's according to the Associated Press. Minnesotans have overwhelmingly given an independent commission control over state legislators' pay. The change to the state's constitution will mean lawmakers will no longer decide if they should get a raise. DFL Senator Kent Eakin of Twin Valley sponsored the amendment to change the state's constitution because he says it's a conflict of interest for legislators to set their own pay. And the last time lawmakers gave themselves a raise was in 1999. They currently make $31,140 a year. The bipartisan 16-member commission will be appointed by the governor and the Minnesota Supreme Court Chief Justice. Sitting or former lawmakers and their spouses will be barred from the commission, as are lobbyists, judges, and state employees. And again, recapping some news here from the beginning of this break, the Associated Press has declared winners in a trio of hotly contested congressional races in Minnesota on Election Day. Jason Lewis declared the winner in the race for the second congressional seat. In the 8th District, Rick Nolan has been declared the winner. And in the 1st congressional district, Tim Walz has been declared the winner in that race as well. And as you heard, NPR News replayed the Donald Trump victory speech from earlier tonight. And while Donald Trump has been declared the winner in the race for the White House, it's still unclear. It's not official yet whether Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton won the state of Minnesota, with most of the precincts reporting Hillary Clinton a very slight lead over Donald Trump for those 10 electoral votes in the state of Minnesota. And as you try to absorb the results of this election this year, you'll do so today. Nice weather in Minnesota. The nice weather will continue for the rest of the overnight hours. It'll be clear, lows in the upper 20s to mid 30s. For Wednesday, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 50s to mid 60s. Tonight, it'll be clear, lows in the upper 30s to mid 40s. Then on Thursday, our string of nice weather continues. More sunshine, highs ranging from the mid-50s to mid-60s a little later on this week. And keep it tuned to Minnesota Public Radio News for continued reaction both nationally and regionally on the election results from the from this year's election, wrapping up in the wee hours of this morning. This is Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 3:40.
From NPR News, this is live election night coverage. I'm Corva Coleman. I'm joined now by my colleague, NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben. Hello, Danielle.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You have been looking at some exit polling, and I understand that it is very, very rich.
It is, yeah. I mean, we've been watching these roll in overnight, and slowly as that happened, the picture went from blurry to a bit sharper.
So what exactly is exit polling, and how is it different from the polls that have been predicting what was going to happen in the presidential election?
Right. So those polls, which a lot of people are kind of, you know, wondering about right now, those are generally done by phone or online. Whereas exit polling, you know, it is what it sounds like. They get people as they are exiting the polling place, and they ask them, okay, you know, they ask them about who'd you vote for and that sort of thing. Now, except in states where there is mail-in voting, for example, Washington, Colorado, those people, they do poll by phone.
So what are some of the biggest gaps?
So the gender gap is something that I've been watching this whole election, and it is on track to potentially be the largest we've seen in a very long time. Now, it looks like right now in the exit polling data, Clinton is leading among women by 12 points, and Trump is leading among men by around 12 points. Now, those numbers could shift a little bit, but it looks like Clinton is doing about the same that Obama did among women in 2012. However, it appears that Trump may have roughly doubled Romney's lead among men from 2012.
Okay. Yeah. Wasn't the polling telling us that Clinton's gap with women would actually be larger?
Some polling was, yeah. You know, in these last few days, those tracking polls bounced around a lot, so it was hard to get a really good picture on it. But yeah, what we have seen, though, is even if Clinton's gap wasn't larger, the sexes do appear to be fairly far apart.
We've heard a lot about the big educational split among white voters this election. Did you see that split show up?
Absolutely. Now, here's what's interesting. Whites preferred Romney by around 20 points, and whites as a whole preferred Trump by around 20 points. But within those populations, the college-educated and non-college-educated people split further apart than they were in 2012. Right now, exit polling, and once again, these numbers are tentative. Trump is winning non-college whites by around 40 points. Romney's lead among them was 26. So it at least appears moderately, if not more, bigger than Romney won them by. Meanwhile, Trump is roughly even among college-educated whites. Now, that may not sound like a big deal, but a lot of pollsters had thought, you know, maybe Clinton could win college-educated whites for the first time in decades, and that doesn't quite appear to have happened.
I wonder what happened.
I mean, that's the question we're asking about all the polling. What happened?
What happened? Okay.
Yeah.
So let's compare this to 2012. Obama won by 4 points nationwide. Do we have any idea where Clinton underperformed him, didn't do as well as Obama did?
Well, if you drill down in some of these battleground states, you get at least a few ideas. Let's go to Michigan. Wayne County is by far the most populous county in Michigan. Obama beat Romney there by around 381,000 votes. Now, last I checked before I came in the studio, Clinton was beating Trump there by 280,000. So that's a 100,000 point gap in this one very populous county, but in a very key battleground state. We've seen similar sorts of things in Milwaukee County, Philadelphia County. So when you really drill down in these battleground states, you see where the weaknesses are, where Clinton's people just didn't show up.
Do we have any idea what happened with the polls that happened to be wrong?
You know, I asked one pollster that I talk to fairly often, and he came back with, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I think this is the question you're going to see play out in the coming weeks, months, you know, by 2018 and 2020. But, you know, what he did say was, first of all, maybe we got turnout wrong. I mean, it's looking right now that, you know, turnout could have been higher in some areas, lower in some areas than we thought. Also, you know, it's easy to maybe overdraw conclusions here, but you compare this to Brexit, you compare this to the FARC vote in Colombia. I mean, those are different countries, of course. But what I saw one pollster on Twitter, Patrick Murray at Monmouth, what I saw him saying was, maybe there's something about voters being very angry and just having so much vitriol that somehow, you know, makes polls a little bit less reliable. We're not sure yet.
When do you think we might know? How long might it take?
I I don't know. I think we're going to see it, in the coming days or weeks. It's not going to be overnight. Pollsters are puzzled.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's Danielle Kurtzleben from NPR's Election Desk. Again, Danielle, thank you very much.
Of course.
Earlier this evening, our colleagues Ari Shapiro and Rachel Martin spoke with some of NPR's politics team, Domenica Montanaro, Asma Khalid, and Mara Liasson. Let's listen in.
Pennsylvania was a huge deal, right? I mean, this is a place that has not gone Republican since 1988. And Hillary Clinton was off from what Barack Obama did. Close, but off. About 20,000 or so votes short of what Barack Obama was able to do. You've seen that in across a lot of the states that she needed, where in the big city she wasn't able to get out the vote that she needed. But I will say this. What's fascinating is that the usual counties – that you look at as swing states, Hillary Clinton in a lot of places hit her marks. Bucks County. Everyone talked about Bucks County, Pennsylvania. What was going on? Where what you're seeing is sort of a red tide rising. Where, you know, we talk about a lot of those red counties throughout the state that didn't have many votes, but you saw a lot more of them as they propelled Trump to victory.
Asma, you want to jump in?
Yeah, and Domenico, I think maybe the counter to that, though, is that Hillary Clinton wasn't really able to bring out the voters that she needed. I was just looking at some of the turnout figures around African-American voters. According to the exit polls right now out of Pennsylvania, it looks like only 10% of the voters were African-American. It was 13% 4 years ago. That's a problem.
I mean, we are seeing a political transformation here. I think that you have seen Latinos definitely go out to the polls. You've seen Arizona and Nevada, you know, places like that where normally you would think would be either more competitive or leaning Republican, not. And you're seeing instead in the Midwest this path that I've called earlier the trade winds path for Donald Trump, where this populist nativist message, anti-establishment message has really resonated with a lot of voters, people who have felt disaffected from the political system, who really dislike the elites, and what Mara was talking about when it comes to institutions.
I got to say, you call it the trade winds path, and yet nearly every major swing state has gone for Donald Trump. It's not path so much as it is a wash. I mean, Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Iowa, yeah. Pennsylvania. It is this long, long list of formerly blue, now red states.
But you know what we also don't know? The Brexit analogy is so interesting, mm-hmm. because what Brexit really was something that starkly divided British society. Young against old, rural against urban, yep. educated against non-educated. And I have a feeling that when Asma's finished sifting through all the data, maybe she'll confirm this, but there were deep divisions on age and gender and race and class, and education in America has now become a proxy for class.
Mm-hmm. You know,
the more highly educated, the more you're a Democrat. Yeah. And one of Donald Trump's most famous sayings was, "I love the poorly educated."
But Mara is saying is so accurate in terms of an age divide. I mean, look, where Hillary Clinton didn't do well with millennials, it's not that she lost those voters to Donald Trump. It's that she potentially might have lost them to a third-party candidate. I mean, overwhelmingly, we see millennials tilt sort of more liberal, even on social issues, on immigration issues. And so we do see a divide already in the exit polls among voters over the age of 40.
Which goes back to the Democrats clearing the field
for her. And all of the problems that the Republican Party and the autopsy report and other conversations have laid out as long-term problems for the party, if you're not for doing something about global warming, if you're not for gay marriage, although we don't really know where Donald Trump is actually probably pro-gay marriage. Yeah. I think he said some things about that. But if you're not for these things or for immigration reform, then young people are going to tune you out. Those problems haven't gone away. This was, as Domenico said, kind of red states rising, or you could call it the revenge of the Reagan Democrats. But this is a divided country, and one half, or a little more than half, who felt left out has now grabbed back the control.
So, you know, all year we've been talking about GOP in crisis, civil war within the Republican Party, whither the GOP. Should we now be asking Democratic Party in crisis?
No,
with the Democrats?
I really don't think so. I think that the Republican Party still isn't sure what it wants. Now it's going to be remade in the Trumpian image. It'll be a protectionist, more isolationist, nativist party, I think, unless he changes once he gets into the White House. The Democratic Party still believes in, you know, diversity, and that we should do something about global warming, and that the government should help people pay for college and get health care.
But is the DNC going to seek out people to run who aren't establishment politicians?
Sure,
people who have
sure.
a more outsider kind of appeal.
The big question for the DNC, and they'll probably have one of those "what just happened to us" commissions, which every losing party does, mm-hmm. is, you know, why did they fail? Was it Hillary Clinton? And I think she was the ultimate status quo past candidate in a race that was supposed to be about the future. And change.
I think there is going to be some Democratic hand-wringing. One thing on the rural-urban divide, it was huge tonight, okay? I mean, 62-34 for Trump, people who live in rural areas, 59-35 for Clinton, for people who live in urban areas. That's a 52-point rural-urban gap. Nothing may be bigger than that.
You know, and one figure that I saw so much earlier this evening that I don't remember the exact number, but it stood out to me, is the very high percentage of Americans who don't know anyone who is voting for the opposite candidate voting for.
And here's another poll, little polling data point, is 90% of each candidate's supporters said that they couldn't support or feel good about the other candidate being president. Huh. That means that, you know, we're so tribal and so divided.
So can I just chime in real quick on the, you know, Democratic hand-wringing or not hand-wringing? And to me, what's really interesting, and Domenico and I have talked about this so many times, is demography, right? And this election was supposed to be the election that had the smallest share of the white electorate.
And it might have been.
Even if it did, it's still, say, 70% white. And what I think is really interesting is, you know, I've seen sort of younger Republican pollsters tonight on Twitter saying, yes, this is a winning strategy for now. It'll win you now. It might win you next, you know, the next election too, but it's not a long-term game plan. But I think on the reverse side for Democrats, if you are losing white voters by consistently large margins, that's also not a really winning strategy for the short term.
There are some out there, I imagine, Mara, who are saying, how do you go from Barack Obama to Donald Trump?
It's very
more
common.
Opposite men, could you not find?
Well, it's very common that each president is kind of a reaction against
right. Think about the pendulum.
Yeah, the pendulum swings a little far, and sometimes the new president overreacts to the failings of the previous one and goes too far in the opposite direction. But Donald Trump has been called by Republicans as well as Democrats the least prepared president, least qualified president, the least curious, intellectually curious, willing to do the work of policy, all those things. Now, he is going to be the most powerful person on the planet. So we are entering totally uncharted territories. As your interviewee said recently, it's like looking into the abyss.
What does it mean for Obama's legacy?
Well, his legacy is going to be chipped away at pretty fast in pretty short order.
Think about Obamacare, mm-hmm. you know, think about all the executive orders that the president has put into order. That's
suspending deportations.
Right. First thing off the bat is what Donald Trump said that he's going to go after. So you can all be almost guaranteed that, you know, in the Senate, in a Republican controlled Senate, that they will try to pass some sort of repeal of Obamacare, and they'll do it through reconciliation if they have to, which would only require 51 votes.
I wonder if, as Republicans end up controlling the House, the Senate, the Supreme Court, the White House, the system of checks and balances is all sort of leaning towards the Republicans. Are there checks on a President Trump, particularly as this is a person who tends towards secrecy, maybe tends towards overreaching?
The only thing you can look to in the Senate is the filibuster. And, there was a record use of the filibuster under President Obama. You could probably be guaranteed that there would be, some kind of use of the filibuster if there were particularly onerous items that Democrats just felt went far too far. The smart play for Donald Trump would be to work with a Mitch McConnell, who knows the system better than anybody, and to work with Paul Ryan, or somebody else who they decide they'd like to be speaker. You never know. But I think that working with the leaders in the Senate and in the House is probably the best path to getting something passed for Trump. So maybe Democrats' best hope is that Republican leaders would be a check on whatever items they find to be most extreme from Donald Trump. But you never know what he's going to do. You know, ideologically, he is not pure. He is not somebody who, you know, you can say always believed in a certain way. And the one thing we do know about him is he wants to be liked and he thinks he can make deals. So if he suddenly becomes somebody who can't do those things, you wonder where his head would be at.
That was Ari Shapiro and Rachel Martin speaking with members of NPR's politics team. You're listening to live coverage from NPR News. I'm Corva Coleman with NPR News. I'm joined by Ray Suarez, my colleague who is at KQED in San Francisco, and he's been covering this historic night. Hello, Ray.
Hi, Corva.
Well, if you're just waking up, about 2:30 this morning Eastern Time, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump was declared the winner of the U.S. presidential election. Ray, what are your thoughts about President-elect Donald Trump?
Well, you know, he will quickly move to consolidate his team and move forward and get ready to take over the presidency. That's a slow process, and politics has a way of slowly coalescing those kinds of forces. One thing that doesn't slowly coalesce is business. It reacts very quickly. Asian markets were convulsing this morning when it became clear that Donald Trump was going to be the next president of the United States. The Dow futures were suspended because they dropped several hundred points, and the triggers came in, the blocks came in and stopped trading on Dow's futures until the markets open in a few hours' time. The Mexican peso has been all over the place as Trump's fortunes have waxed and waned. When it was believed that Hillary Clinton was going to win, the Mexican peso began to firm up because of Trump's much ballyhooed opposition to free trade with Mexico. Now that it's clear that he's going to be the next president of the United States, the peso is under tremendous pressure, and on some markets it's been trading at historic lows against the dollar. So there'll be some interesting twists and turns. The Chinese are very unhappy because they know about Donald Trump's opposition to trade deals with China. There's going to be some very interesting developments on the financial front as America gets up and starts its Wednesday workday with a new president-elect.
Ray, this result is very surprising. Most polls had suggested that Hillary Clinton had a very narrow but discernible lead coming into this election.
The polls had coalesced around a 3 to 4 point lead. And, you know, there were a couple of polls that were doubtful, that didn't have that number, that were saying that they had nagging statistical signs that Trump had a slight lead, and slight lead in key states. But they were considered outliers because the rest of the polling industry had sort of fallen in line around a 3 to 4% lead. So they're going to have to go back and look at their models and figure out what they did wrong as well, because coming on the heels of the Israeli election, the Brexit vote, many other key polling moments, not just here but around the world, there's something that their models are missing. There's something that the computers are missing, a human element that is not easily measurable.
And that's it for us. Ray Suarez, big thank you so much from KQED.
Great to talk to you.
NPR's coverage will continue online at npr.org. Please join us and stay tuned for more coverage on Morning Edition from NPR News. You're listening to special coverage, election coverage from NPR News.
And this is Minnesota Public Radio News. Good morning. Just coming up on the 4 o'clock hour. I'm Mike Moen. Early this morning, here's what we know so far for the state of Minnesota in terms of election results. We've had some winners declared over the past hour in some tight congressional races here in the state. In the first district, Tim Walz survives a scare against Republican challenger in that particular race. And also in the 8th congressional district, we had Rick Nolan retaining his seat in that district with a very narrow victory over Stuart Mills. And in the excuse me, in another congressional district, second congressional district tonight, excuse me, Republican Jason Lewis will be Minnesota's newest member of Congress, defeating DFLer Angie Craig for the seat left open when Congressman John Klein retired. And this is Minnesota Public Radio News, 91.1 KNOW, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Listener-supported radio. A reminder, you can always find more news anytime at nprnews.org.